was to free up those quote-unquote excess lands.
So that the lands were lost to Indian ownership through sale of the surplus, and then by one means and another through assignment of the allotments in fee.
That's right.
Yeah. And Mr. Jim?
If I may elaborate a little further, and I appreciate very much Mr. Gottschalk's analysis of the General Allotment Act, the Dawes Act of 1887. To be somewhat frighteningly specific, many of our people, we still hear the stories of non-Indians getting some Indian drunk, and the next morning he wakes up with money in his pocket and his thumbprint on a piece of paper which is in the possession of the non-Indian and said, "You sold me your land last night." The jurisdictional nightmare should be elaborated on somewhat, wherein land that went out of trust status because of the General Allotment Act, since 83 to 80, continuously haunts and plagues many of the tribes in the lower 48. The enforcement of certain types of laws on the fee patent, the checkerboard of the reservation, is very difficult. And in regard to the allotment of 80 acres, or if it was in a supposedly semi-worthless area, like for instance the area I grew up in was in a canyon, and the mainstream looks at that canyon as rock, sagebrush, semi-worthless land, so instead of 80, let him have 120, expand it a little bit. Or if it's way out there in the wilds in the timbered area, let's give him 160 to make up for the distance. But there was so much surplus land there left, and not enough Indians, not enough Yakimas to give land to. So we had visitors from the coast, from the Nez Perce, from the Coeur d'Alenes, from the Colville, from the Warm Springs, the Umatillas, that were living on our land. And so they gave them allowance, which creates another problem. And I'm sure somebody will address this problem one of these days, the inheritance problem that comes along with that. And it's very complex. And again, I agree with Kim that it's somewhat frightening. Thank you.
David Case.
Yeah, Kim, I wonder if you could be a little more specific about the relationship you see between the pattern of difficulties with the Allotment Act, and particularly the airship issue, and the Claims Act. And I guess, are you talking about the analogy between allotments and stock in the corporations, or something else?
Yeah, that what I'm talking about, I guess the overriding analogy is that there's a time certain at which the Indian interests are fair game. And you will be, if it stays the way it is, I think people will look back with grudging admiration at the ability of white society to get huge hunks of that in amazingly short periods of time. I think it's an emergency.
Let me just carry this a little bit further. Suppose the stock were perpetually restricted, but could be passed only as it is now by inheritance. What, if anything, would be the consequences of that?
Well, you get me into an area that I really not that capable of talking about, because I think it gets into the area that Coulter has raised and many others about what is the ultimate vision. I don't know if this is even the ultimate system that they want. All I'm saying is, if you can't come up with an ultimate system by 1991, certainly some type of continuation of the restriction it buys you some time. As far as it has nothing to do with the afterborn situation, which I think would seem to me as an outsider is an extremely serious problem. And to me, that's going to require more than just a slight modification of some time periods. Obviously, there's, to me, there's a major overhaul needs to be done. I'm worried about the impending time periods, and I don't know. I think maybe all types of strategies, not just in the sense that they've been talked about earlier, but in the sense of time-wise, all different levels of strategy need to be pursued. Short range, mid-term, and long range. What the specifics of those are, I mean, that's where I agree with the observation that in the long term, perhaps lawyers should be latecomers to the whole thing. Lawyers cannot be latecomers to the 1991 problem because it's here right now.
In the case of the allotments, is the consequence of the lands being restricted and passed by airship.
Okay, well, it's not as analogous in that situation because stocks are more easily divisible. But the what has happened is a whole new set of problems that have also given rise to lawsuits called secretarial transfers. You end up with a piece of land with maybe each person owning 1/64th interest, and so what do? So Congress passed an act that said, well, the secretary, upon application of the heirs, or if one heir was found to be incompetent, not in the mental sense, then he could sell the allotment. And so many of those have been sold without the application of the heirs, and there's many lawsuits brewing in the lower 48 at this very moment based on that. There have also been provisions passed saying, I can't remember the precise formula, but if a piece of land is of a certain size, you know, a small size, if its income-producing ability is very small, it automatically escheats to the tribe. And so now there are lawsuits by individual Indians suing over that, arguing that that statute is unconstitutional because it's taking their property away. But the heirship problem has just been devastating. I mean, you have land sitting there that so many people own and such a small interest in it that no productive use can be made of it. There are all kind of arguments over what's going to be done with it. It's just a total disaster.
Just before we go to Mr. Lerner, David Case, would you like to supplement in any way what Mr. Gottschalk has said by referring to allotments in Alaska?
Well, the airship problem is the same with allotments in Alaska, except that, of course, the Allotment Act that was primarily implemented up here was a public domain allotment act. It did not divide up reservations. It took land out of the so-called public domain and theoretically, largely, made it available for Alaska Natives. But you have the same airship problem in Alaska that arises out of the fact that one person obtains an allotment and then passes it on by inheritance to several people, who then pass it on by inheritance to several other people, who then pass it on to several other people, and of course within two or three generations you have sometimes 100 people owning the same 160 acres of land or less, and no division of the it just makes it very difficult to deal with the land as an economic unit, for one thing. and usually often ends up in the land being leased to an outside economic interest, which then can return cash as a payment for the lease, which can be distributed among 100 people, whereas the land can't. So you see the institution itself sort of divides up and does very often devastating things to the people and their relationship to the land. You want to say something, and I don't want to...
Well, I was just going to say there's a side issue to that that is even compounds it further. In Minnesota, where I was mentioning they have the secretarial transfer problems, where the Secretary of the Interior transferred land without the consent of the heirs, they've estimated that the probate work to go back and find out who all the heirs are alone would cost $40 million. No one knows who the heirs even are. It's been so long since work has been done on it.
And just to tie this, maybe it's obvious, but nobody ever says this, but I suppose it's important to say this, that you have to sort of look at the result of inheriting ANCSA stock. And the way the Claims Act, of course, was set up, every person got 100 shares in a particular corporation, or maybe 100 shares in each of two corporations. And then those people will pass those 100 shares on, perhaps to multiple heirs, who will then pass them on to multiple heirs, and you will have the same increasing division of these 100 shares into, they're more easily divisible. But the question then becomes, what is the value in any term, and maybe there is some value, of owning one share, or two shares, or five shares in a corporation? Whatever the value is, it is probably not economic value.
I agree with that. When I said it wasn't quite as analogous, I meant the precise point you made, that since it's 100 shares, it is somewhat more easily mathematically divisible, but ultimately you reach the same problem.
Mr. Lerner, and then Daly Sambo, and then Joseph Jorgensen. Sorry. I'm told that some of the corporations are down to fractions of less than a share on their rolls, and that's only 12 years after. Ralph Lerner? Yeah.
I first raised my hand because there was something I didn't understand in what you had mentioned. You said under certain conditions, the land is ceded to the community, to the tribe.
That's a very recent statute, and it's being tested now. If a person's interest in land fell below a certain percent, and its income-producing ability fell below a certain dollar amount, they just declared it as ceded to the tribe, and that's now being challenged in court
by individuals who don't want to give up what they owned. Thought now, nice. Let me just raise a question, and this is something that lawyers would know about. In a big city, you could have an apartment building that is run not as a condominium but as a cooperative, okay? Where, strictly speaking, you don't own the apartment in which you may be living, but a fraction of the building of which that apartment is a part. And that apartment building, or the owners of that the cooperative, has an interest in maintaining the character of that building. Yeah. They might not want to have an apartment taken over by young swingers, okay? We're going to have party time at 3 a.m., yeah? Or they might have other kinds of motives. They want to have some control over who lives there and how that person or that family will comport itself. So they have an arrangement. I've heard of it. I don't live myself in such an arrangement. They have an arrangement whereby if you want to move out of that apartment and you're going somewhere else, and you want to sell your apartment, before you can sell to a ready buyer, that buyer must have the approval of the board. Or, if the board turns down that potential buyer, the board reserves the right, the cooperative as it were, reserves the right to be the first buyer of that apartment. Now, there are all kinds of arrangements that lawyers have concocted for people who want to have some control over their neighborhood. In the old days, people used to worry about black people moving into white fancy neighborhoods, and they had restrictive covenants, which have been struck down by the law, but have contrived other devices whereby they have some kind of control over who buys. Not over your right to sell, but over the identity of the buyer. Now that's under a cooperative arrangement. Your individual right to your property remains in the sense that it is your title, but the community, whether it's a cooperative or what, an apartment building or what have you, preserves some leverage in maintaining the special character that it wants for that building or that neighborhood or that something or other. I wonder if that's out of the question. That's one question. The second is very brief. The fact that one had only a share, or 100 shares, or it doesn't matter, in a corporation, or in a cooperative for that matter, and that that becomes divisible and divisible and redivisible, I mean, after all, it's the division of property that led all those younger sons to leave the easternmost settlements of the United States and go west. The farms became so small they couldn't live off of them in eastern Massachusetts and Connecticut and so on. But the fact that the share is divisible doesn't mean that it must be worthless. I would have been very happy if my father had had both the means and the foresight and wit to buy one share of General Motors or General Electric in 1924. That one share would, you know, there's such a thing as splits. Okay. Now, it may be that some of those shares and some of those corporations, because of good luck and good management and whatever else goes into it, may become very, very valuable indeed and maintain a multitude of descendants. It may be, but it may also be that they'll be very small.
Well, right. And that, I mean, the point that I meant to make is not that this is necessarily bad, that shares, 100 shares will be divided up down through generations. It kind of depends on your expectancy, though, as to what is going to be the economic benefit of owning shares in ANGSA corporations. And the expectancy may have been that owning 100 shares of a corporation would result in some fairly substantial income to the individual that owned the 100 shares. And the fact that the shares then in later generations become further and further reduced reduces that likelihood. So it depends on the expectancy that you have of this institution. And, you know, and there's a great deal that is also left to chance and later development. That's my only point. I'm not saying that this is bad or good. It's just that there are some consequences to the restriction on shares and the restriction that they're going to be passed by heirship at this point.
Kim Gottschalk.
To answer your question as to whether something like that is possible, it's already in there to a certain extent in 43 U.S.C. 1606. The corporation can buy the cutoff date in 1991 if it so chooses, in addition to any other legally permissible restrictions, of which I have no idea what they are, have a restriction denying voting rights to any holder of stock who is not a native or a descendant of a native, and the granting to the corporation or to the corporation and a stockholder's immediate family the first right to purchase. Okay, so some of what you have said is in there. I leave it to other people to say whether it's adequate. I guess my reaction is, based on my experience in the 48, and the reason I rebel against this provision and your suggestion is, I'm opposed to the whole idea of an economic entity as opposed to a governmental entity anyway. That's what sovereignty is all about, is government, not... in the 48, okay, I don't want to make a value judgment for the people up here, but from the tribes I've worked with, they've been membership entities, not economic entities. They've been governmental entities first, and so in a certain sense, I would reject the premise.
Could I ask you a question, Mr. Gottschalk? You prefer what really are political entities with certain law-making functions. What about the land, where you have land that the tribe or people consider to be theirs? How should it be held? And by what entity?
I don't know if I want to answer how should it be held, but I can answer how it is held with the tribes. Mostly I've worked with the Mescalero tribe, okay? I've been with NAR for a year and a half. I was with the Mescalero tribe for 8 years, and their leader is Wendell Chino, whom I consider to be one of the finest Indian leaders in the country, or one of the finest indigenous leaders in the world, as far as that goes. I know him well enough to know what his response would be to that, and that is the tribe owns every last acre. At least no non-Indian owns any, and the land is essential. And it's held by the tribe as a governmental entity, and the people hold membership in the tribe.
Bedele Sambo and then Ralph Johnson and... Joe, and then Ralph, sorry.
Under the General Allotment Act, it seems that it's taken, in terms of allotting land to people on an individual basis, has broken down the tribal institution and severed the land that once belonged to the tribe in common or communal or held within the tribe. So what's the responsibility of the tribe as a tribe to the individual allottees, and it seems to have broken down in an essential part of an Indian community by allotting on an individual basis.
Well, without mentioning a specific tribe, but it's a tribe that I'm aware of, they have a real problem having their own people accept the tribe's right to tell them what they can do on the reservation. They have a hard time with the idea of tribal government, because the whole reservation has been so decimated by allotment. It's a terrible problem, and then to compound that, there are Anglo holdings within, and I don't know. To me, it's just this whole idea of allowing Anglos to have their foot in the door by getting some of your stock is just devastating.
Joe Jorgensen.
One problem about allotments and their aftermath that hasn't been discussed yet, but should be, is what does happen when, through secretarial transfer or through purchase, funds made available by Congress for tribe to buy back allotments or land tied up in airship, what does it do to the former allottees or those who presume to be the heirs? And one problem is that when the IRA governments then receive this land back, they were authorized to assign land for use by Indian persons who desired to use the land. This would allow them to farm, to raise livestock, to and engage in any small enterprise. Here are some of the kinds of problems that have emerged from that on several of the reservations on which I've worked over the years. The former allottees or heirs have been unclear about the nature of the transfer, even if they received payment back for the transfer. Many of the transfers of allotment and airship land on some of these reservations were made to pay back debts incurred in irrigation projects put on those reservations that had not been desired or voted upon or agreed to by the allottees or their heirs, or the tribes themselves, as a matter of fact. When they knew that they had land that would be theirs, they assumed in perpetuity, of course it was a 25-year trust, that first wedge, a wedge perhaps that Ralph Lerner could talk about, was made. That's to say, they now became individual property owners, which was what was desired by some framers of the General Allotment Act in the first place. If a person would but assume land, he would become responsible for his family and for the continuation of that family through time. And if they were witty and wise and used their resources well, they could purchase more land on their own. But what I saw in the 1950s and the 1960s were such things as fist fights, challenges to the authority of the tribe to assign land. I saw land assigned to people and the tribe afraid to take it away from them, even if it was not in use for several years, when someone else wanted to use the land and have it assigned to them. That there were these conflicts about who owned the land, for what purposes it should be used, and whether the tribe, by its authority, could control land that was presumed to belong to former allottees or former heirs. It could be awfully divisive. The contradictions then that emerged have continued on, and they haven't gone away. That there would be corporate resolve among all members of the community without factional disputes or catch-as-catch-can wrestling matches is not a foregone conclusion. I think that without a larger land base, without some way to take care of future generations, that ANCSA will run into precisely the same kind of problems that have emerged on these various Indian reservations, especially in the western United States. Sometimes these problems on allotments and assignments can be compounded, particularly if oil and gas happens to be on those reserves. Allottees or heirs control the subsurface rights. They lease their oil and gas. They receive directly the benefits from it. Assignment land next door, once owned by Indians, now still residing on the reservation, also have oil and gas wells put in place, but those monies go back to the tribe, and they feel that they have been deeply deprived. Those kinds of problems are very serious and very real on several reservations.
Ralph Johnson.
I'd like to call forth an analogy from the other field that I spend most of my time in, and that is the field of public land law. Just as an introduction, about a week ago, a federal judge in Portland, Oregon, enjoined all herbicide spraying in all national forest lands and all BLM lands in all of Oregon and all of Washington because of the failure of the National Forest Service and the BLM to prepare what's known as a worst-case analysis. The National Environmental Policy Act was enacted in 1969. In 1979, the president issued an executive order, President Carter did, saying that the only way we're going to find out the important information about the impact of federal projects, for example, spraying herbicides on national forest land, is to have the agency prepare something explicitly identifying the worst possible results that could come from that. The agencies don't like to do that. In fact, they refuse to do it. They refuse to do it time and again, even though ordered by the court to do so. As I said, about 2 weeks ago, the Ninth Circuit simply ordered the agency to stop all herbicide spraying in all of those two states until such a worst-case analysis was prepared. Now, a worst-case analysis is different than what some of you might think. You can't brush aside the possibility that the disaster that has been alluded to here by Kim Gottschalk and David Case and others might occur. You can't just say, well, there's not very much chance of that, so we don't have to consider it. A worst-case analysis requires that you spell out what that worst-case possibility is and some idea of the chances of that occurring. You have to write it out. You have to say, this might occur, and this might occur, and this might occur. And I suspect that revealing that information will affect those who are making decisions about it. And as I say, if you just shunt it off and say, well, there isn't very much chance of that happening, then people blank it out of their mind. But there is a whole methodology now that requires you to spell that out. Say, what would be the worst case? For example, on the herbicide spraying, there is some chance that 50 women will have spontaneous abortions in the area that is sprayed. There's been some evidence that that is true. Forest Service and BLM said, well, we don't think that's true and that isn't likely, but they couldn't prove it wasn't true. And so they must reveal in their analysis that this could be the result. Then the public, the federal agencies, the Congress, the people who are all of who are going to decide that question will be able to decide, do we want to go ahead with that? And that, it seems to me, is where we are here. One can ask for an explicit revelation of what is the worst case analysis of 1991. Not whether it might likely occur or not, but what is that analysis? And then let's consider, do we want to take the chance? Is there any way we can reduce the chances of that happening? Is there any way to plug those holes so that won't happen? And then think of the avenues to go about it. I think that methodology is available. It's a question that fits very appropriately here and should be asked and should be analyzed here.
Yes, Russell Jim. Oh, sorry. I see. Yes, Russell Jim.
Thank you. I certainly agree with Professor Johnson, but I think it warrants a little elucidation in regard to some of the worst-case analysis, and that is in regard to the allotments on the Yakima Nation. In 1953, with the fast pace, a fast change in the value system by the Yakima people themselves in selling off their allotments to anyone, non-Indian alike, the Yakima Nation exercised its sovereignty in 1953 through the General Council body and passed a resolution that says no more land will be sold to non-Indians. But as I mentioned earlier, there are these allotments that are up in the timbered area, which is a closed area to non-Yakimas on the Yakima Reservation, especially during the fire season. But these allotments are inherited eventually under the laws of the United States of America, and the one allotment specifically, I'm sure Professor Johnson knows the case of the Yakima versus Brendale. Mr. Brendale was about a 16th or a 64th short of being an enrolled Yakima member, but he inherited this 160 acres from his mother, whom was enrolled and had passed on, and through the laws that were created here not too long ago, the gentleman inherited. And so eventually he wanted to develop. He wanted to divide 10 acres up there into 2-acre plots and sell them to non-Indians up in a closed area, which is a beautiful area up there in the timber. And we argued you can't do this. The Yakima Nation, through its own sovereignty and through its zoning ordinance and code, controls all lands within the exterior boundaries of the reservation. Of course, you know, the ramifications and the court cases that have always come out of that. But we did eventually have to go to court. And first, the county commissioners in Yakima says, well, we grant Mr. Brendale the right to develop. I'll make it short as I can, but eventually the Yakima Nation won the case. And there's still, the question still is among the county commissioners, should we appeal? But this is one of the worst case analysis that could be thought about and thought hard about. The development and the manner promoted inside the closed area was going to affect the resource, the important resource itself, the environment, the aesthetics, animal habitat, and the bottom line, the natural foods and medicines that are very essential to the culture of the Yakima Nation. I could elaborate further, but I think I'll let it stop right there.
Yes, well, I wonder if I could make a suggestion now. It's about 5 minutes to three. Tito Naranjo brought this movie with him, and I suggest that we adjourn now to watch the movie, and then everyone in the hall, I repeat, is invited back to the commission's offices for refreshments at 4:30. Tito Naranjo has to leave tomorrow morning, so I think we should show the movie now and then invite Tito to say a few words to us after that. And I have some more hands up. Yes, Ralph Lerner?
Could you spare 3 minutes?
All right.
Okay. You know, this appalling narrative you gave, I mean, of these allotment frauds, encouraged, I think, under, you know, because of the individual's inability to work within the confines of white property law. I mean, just simply dreadful. I wonder whether that example of the lower 48, I'm talking like a native already here, okay, I mean Alaskan, okay. I wonder whether that experience of the lower 48 is so necessary or fearsome up here. Let me just suggest a couple of things that strike me as putting Alaska in a special and maybe more favorable light. First of all, the very thing that seems so ominous, that you've really got only 7 years and the clock is running, might actually be working in your favor rather than against your favor. I'll explain that in a second. And the other thing, that you've got so much territory, an immense amount of land. What's that? You may say not enough, but it gives you room for maneuver and error. Let me suggest a possibility. When you have more time, you have more time for the division of minds. Maybe it's possible that with some tribes or some corporations or some boroughs, there's something approaching unanimity. We don't want that. X. Okay? We want to be able to control it according to a certain vision that we have. That would be the moment, it seems to me, to act on that before people have had a chance to divide to form the kind of factious behavior that Mr. Jorgensen described. To the extent that you're talking about a community meaning having a common mind about the most important things, whatever those things are for those people, is it out of the question that that community, that those individuals vested by the law with these individual shares, should contract with one another to form some kind of an organization, some kind of a community, and even if it has to be called corporation, so be it, whereby their common purposes, their common interests, their common dream might be served? That community, recognizable by the law, corporate law, property law, whatever it is that falls, the law of associations, that's a recognizable in falling under the protections of white law for such arrangements, might then make what arrangements it pleased. For example, I would imagine that the first thing that they might want to do is to provide for all their children, the 11-year-olds as well as the 12-year-olds. I can't imagine a human being that would, you know, that would settle for saying yes for this kid and not for that. And again, talking not about giving him a parcel, which will then be inadequate in the third generation, but giving him a share. That corporation could then arrange the use of that land, distributing it and arranging for its use in any fashion that it saw fit. Probably there would be all kinds of divisions of mind. Probably you'd have politics, the sort of thing that Ms. Deer alluded to in talking about the Menominees and other. Because Indians and Aleuts and Eskimos, like other people, are going to have divided minds about what's good and how to go about it. But if you've got actually a moment, and it'll only be a moment probably, when you have some kind of clarity and agreement about it, maybe that's the moment to strike and settle for that, and at least foreclose the possibility, insofar as human beings could foreclose anything, that the whole thing will just be frittered away in divisiveness and mutual recriminations. There is a place where I think a lawyer could be helpful.
Ada Deer?
This will be short. In terms of analogies between the Dawes Act and the ANSCA, some framers of the Dawes Act had the vision that this would solve the Indian problem. It has compounded the lives of thousands of people and didn't solve anything from the Indians' point of view. One of the speakers talked earlier about the object of getting the land. That was a masterful way to separate Indians from the land. I look at ANSCA and I see this corporate model that has been referred to as model legislation as an economic instrument that will shatter the lives and the lands of the people up here unless something is done. I see cultural arrogance in the drafters of the Dawes Act, and I see the same arrogance, pettiness, smugness, and self-satisfaction in the minds of some of the drafters of the ANSCA legislation. Perhaps the white drafters, the aides and some of these other people, We're not as clear in telling everyone what they had in their minds. And I know that this is a major piece of legislation. I don't know if all the people that were involved in drafting this legislation fully understood the implications of this, but I'm certain that some of the major drafters of this legislation knew exactly what they are doing in getting the land. And I think it's imperative on the parts of all concerned to look with vision in rectifying this before it gets too late.
Well, I think, Walter Parker, the last word this afternoon.
Just as a quick add-on to that, of course it was in the overview statement, at least one of the drafts, one of the business leaders in Alaska made it quite clear that he felt the business community should get behind the act because the land would be in private hands, ergo transferable. And as a brief comment on the allotments, and I've been waiting for somebody who's been more involved in the last few years in allotments in Alaska and myself to speak up, but nobody's come forward. They are probably around 8,000 allotments filed in Alaska, only probably less than 1,000 of which have been processed. Most were filed immediately prior to the passage of the act on the fear of Alaska Legal Services and many Alaska Natives that the act would not pass, therefore get some land while it could be gotten. And those are still on the books, and whether there is a major problem or not depends, you know, on how vigorously the applicants want to pursue their rights.
Yes, just following up on what Mr. Parker said, there is a point of view in Alaska that if the corporations come under the control of non-natives and thus the land under the control of non-natives, that, nevertheless, is entirely in keeping with the purposes of the Act, because the Act was really an event in the mighty struggle between the state of Alaska and the federal government to bring federal lands under state jurisdiction. And by that reasoning, and it's quite explicit and regarded by many, I'm sure, as perfectly legitimate, by that reasoning, the land held by Alaska Native corporations today is land in private hands under state jurisdiction. What was formerly federal land is now in private hands under state jurisdiction. If the corporations cease to be controlled by Native persons and their land ceases to be controlled by Native persons, it is nevertheless still land in private hands under state jurisdiction. That's a view expressed last year by Governor Hickel, who was, I believe, the Secretary of Interior at the time of ANCSA, in at any rate, comes from a man whose credentials are well known to Alaskans. Well, could we start at 9:30 in the morning? I know some of you, at least Tim Coulter, has to leave, and I thank Tim for coming. Tito Naranjo will have to leave too, and I thank him for coming. Kim Gottschalk will have to leave. Thanks likewise to him. I'm not being more flowery about this because you are, of course, going to be enjoying our hospitality later this afternoon. I think you can leave it to David Case and Rosita Worrell and me to come up with an agenda for tomorrow. And if Daley Sambo and Alfred Starr wish to lead off the proceedings tomorrow, if I may say so, perhaps the most senior and the most junior representatives at our little table here, they will be most welcome. And we will carry on perhaps until noon tomorrow, and that may very well furnish a sufficient examination of these questions for the time being. I haven't forgotten what Ralph Johnson said, that is, that we ought at some time to consider alternatives to ANCSA and IRAs, that is, what instruments might be devised. I think others have adverted to this, that enable us to consider a wider range of alternatives than those that have dominated our discussions last week and this week. And we might join with people in the lower 48 in working together on such an examination. Well, let's watch that movie now.
It'll take a few minutes to set up.
Okay, well, let's have a coffee.
Yeah.
video too.
Thank you. patient is referred to the medicine man to reunite him with his own people.